have police photographing our license plates.
What are we doing for veterans returning home damaged physically and mentally, suffering from depression, homelessness, and suicide?
Why did the Supreme Court deposit corporate money into our electoral process?
Should we redefine middle class as working poor? Or is it just another Wall Street merger?
What's really behind new voter picture ID laws in certain states?
Why aren't NBC, ABC, CBS, and Fox asking these questions?
Welcome to the Reasonable Voice Blog Talk Radio. I'm Marcello Rolando. The mission of the Reasonable Voice is to connect the dots between politics and finance, the need for better and more affordable education, our humanity, world peace, and of course, the arts, which we then gladly provide our listeners, the voting public, as informative food for thought to provoke their self-determination and appetite for equal opportunity. The Reasonable Voices are advocates prioritizing education, preserving our history, leading by example for a peaceful and prosperous world by evoking and embracing the creative artist and political unity as solutions to our challenges. Hello, this is Marcello Rolando, the Reasonable Voice, and on our Blog Talk Radio show today, we want to welcome as a guest the Charlottesville Chief of Police, Tim Longo. Welcome, Chief. How are you doing?
Good afternoon, sir. We're tired, but we're moving forward, and I guess that's the most important thing.
I guess we all know why. Charlottesville certainly has been thrust in the national spotlight since second-year University of Virginia student Hannah Graham went missing. And as most of us know, I'm sure Chief Longo has been, as Chief of Charlottesville Police, has certainly been at the center of that search. We did make arrangements to have this conversation prior to Hannah Graham going missing. So there are other things we wish to discuss. But first of all, Chief, as everyone I'm sure is wondering, what can you tell us about this latest development that Virginia State Police have announced that there's a forensic connection between the Morgan Harrington case and the Hannah Graham case?
Well, Michelle, I'm sure you can appreciate it would be highly inappropriate for me to discuss an investigation that's being conducted by another jurisdiction, so I can't comment on the state police investigation, and frankly won't. I will tell you that we're very focused here in Charlottesville, Albemarle, to find Hannah Graham. We've, as many folks know, I've been very passionate in my plea to the community to help us accomplish that task and to search their properties and to help us search parcels throughout the Charlottesville-Albemarle region. To try to locate this young lady. My counterparts in Albemarle County have been working diligently with the Virginia Department of Emergency Management, the Virginia State Police, local search and rescue volunteers to comb southern Albemarle County. We're moving into parts in northern Albemarle County as we speak, and we're going to search as diligently as we possibly can until we find this young girl. But my focus is, irrespective of the other investigations that are taking place around me, my focus is to find Hannah Graham and to go about this investigation with as much energy as we possibly can sustain.
I appreciate that, and I do understand, Chief Longo. Tell us one thing, if you would. Just you mentioned the various investigations. Remind everyone how many, if you will, different departments and layers of police investigation is going on all around you as you try to fulfill your duties.
Well, I can tell you what other law enforcement partners have worked with us on the Hannah Graham case from the very, very beginning. We've had partnerships both at the state and federal level. The FBI has been actively engaged in helping us do every possible support task that we ask them to do, whether it be putting tips into the records management system, whether it be following up with interviewing witnesses or using technical resources that they have at their disposal to help deal with the various aspects of evidentiary items that we might have acquired along the way in this investigation. Folks here from the Charlottesville-Albemarle area FBI office have been here every single day since this investigation began, and I can't be more grateful to them. Virginia State Police have had resources, boots on the ground, both investigators, people that were helping engaged in search of different parcels of land, the Albemarle County Police Department, the University of Virginia Police Department, the Department of Homeland Security has offered air support to help us search some of these large parcels, Albemarle County Sheriff's Department and their search and rescue team, the University of Virginia, just a countless number of law enforcement agencies. And others throughout the state have reached out to us in an effort to be responsive to our solicitations for additional resources that we might need here.
And of course, obviously, outside of the state of Virginia, the Galveston County Police in Texas were...
The Galveston Sheriff's Office, absolutely. God bless that sheriff's deputy who was attentive to what was happening around, you know, 1,800 miles away in a completely, or 1,300 miles, whatever it is, in a completely another part of the world, was attentive enough, along with a good citizen there in Galveston, to help locate Jesse Matthew. And I can't speak more about the sheriff's department there. They're just absolutely incredibly cooperative. I spoke with the sheriff the night that Jesse Matthew was arrested, and he and his team were just so responsive to us and helped to facilitate this process of extradition in a very smooth way. And we're just grateful that Jesse was taken into custody safely.
You know, Chief, we have a lot of things I want to get to, but obviously this is in the top of, I know, on your list and so many others. And so many rumors swirl around, and people, of course, Monday morning quarterbacking, which I don't like, but I just like to hear it from you. This idea that somehow the Charlottesville police should have known something more than they did know and have kept Jesse Matthew when they had him, even though he said he wanted an attorney. I mean, people forget. Everyone gets their day in court. Everyone's innocent until proven guilty. And the moment a defendant or one who is arrested or under suspicion says, "I want an attorney," what does that do to your position?
Well, you know, let's back up a little bit and get to the first point that you appropriately raise, and that's the whole issue of at what point in time does a person get detained against his or her own free will. We arrested or initiated the process of asking the magistrate to issue an arrest warrant when we had probable cause to believe Mr. Matthew was a suspect in this crime, and not a moment before. When he walked into the police station as he did, he was not under arrest. He was free to leave, and he chose to leave. Mm. At the point that he invokes his right to counsel, we, of course, in concert with the Commonwealth Attorney's Office, respect that right, and will continue to respect the constitutional rights that he is guaranteed. So, you know, while others can sit back and evaluate our actions, I can assure you that we acted appropriately and in accordance with our obligations under our Constitution.
Exactly. And, you know, and people, even this, there was a website put up on something, a fundraising website by supporters of Jesse Matthew for his to raise money for his defense. And they received threats and all kinds of comments. They had to take down the account. And, you know, as a news reporter, I just have to give the facts. But as a talk show host, I'd like to remind people that everyone is innocent until proven guilty. There's an investigation going on. A number of police, different levels of police investigators are involved. And, you know, justice be done is what we're supposed to be about as a nation. Anyway, Chief Tim Longo, let's move on, if we may. I know we won't be moving too far away because this is intentionally sort of a segue to other issues I'd originally planned to ask. But your position has been made very public on how you feel about surveillance cameras, particularly on Charlottesville's downtown mall, which seems to, you know, it was a great, originally a beautiful idea, this area in which you can just walk from shop to shop and restaurants. And I mean, you know, it's the best thing since Times Square for me, or the new Times Square, I should say. And there are surveillance cameras, and they have been, obviously, used and helpful in this particular case, and I'm sure in others as well. How do you feel now that some people are calling for even more surveillance cameras on the downtown mall and I guess other areas in Charlottesville?
Well, let me make clear that certainly isn't a unilateral decision that I get to make. I mean, that's something that council, in concert with the city manager and a broader community, has to really sit down and revisit. When I first began the discussion of video surveillance on a pedestrian mall, in areas where we get a significant amount of pedestrian foot traffic, our University Corner, the West Main Corridor, or other areas to get a lot of pedestrian foot traffic and a lot of movement of people throughout, particularly on weekends, it was several years ago. And you know, obviously privacy issues were part of the discussion, but I think even more so was the relevant questions about data retention and storage and who would have access to images. And at that time, council was not prepared to move forward with further developing that concept into something that we would subsequently implement. I have heard more discussion in the past couple weeks than I've heard previously. Whether or not it's something that our council and our community will ask to revisit, I think it's premature, but we're certainly willing to work to put forth a plan, if you will, or an idea, a rough order of magnitude to what the system could look like, how it would be used in our community, where it would be used, how long the information would be retained, and for what purpose, who would have access to it. Because I really do think that folks are really concerned, not so much about the fact that you're capturing images, but how long are you keeping the images and what are you doing with them?
Yes.
And we can address that through policy and work with our community partners to try to accomplish that. You know, we're law enforcement, the way the evolution of technology has impacted law enforcement is huge, and video surveillance technology is just one aspect of it. License plate readers, DNA data banks, I mean, the list goes on and on and on about how law enforcement accesses technology and for what purpose, and the need to make sure that when that is being done, that it's done with a careful balance against people's civil liberties and constitutional rights. And we're all for policies that help ensure that that's taken into consideration, but I think we do need to have a discussion about video surveillance technology. But again, it's not mine to have unilaterally. It has to be one that council and the community is willing to have.
Yes, and to clear up for those who perhaps, well, even in Charlottesville, but certainly outside of Charlottesville, might need an explanation that Charlottesville municipalities, cities, towns have different structures. It's not like a mini federal government or even a mini state government. In Charlottesville in particular, there's a city council, which is, of course, what Chief Longo is referring to. Several members of the city council, including the city manager, Maurice Jones, have been guests on our show, and they are very active. There have been a number of meetings around the city lately, including one that allowed the public to voice concerns about a Ferguson-like situation or event happening here in Charlottesville. And I had wanted to ask you about that, Chief, so we're there now. Why don't we? What makes Charlottesville less likely to be a Ferguson, Missouri?
Well, there are folks in the community, I think, and that forum that you mentioned that was helped facilitate by some local pastors and our community leadership. Some would say who were present in that forum, it very well could happen in a community like Charlottesville. And look, the reality of it is things can happen anywhere for any purpose under any circumstances. I tend to think in Charlottesville, this is a community that's willing to talk even about difficult issues. And I think it's a community where lines of communication are open. They're open certainly between the police department with our government body. As you said, this is a council manager form of government. The city manager is responsible for the day-to-day operation of city government. Council sets policy and agenda as we move forward. But every element of this government is transparent with respect to a willingness to have discussion and dialogue about really important issues, and the relationship between the police and the community is one of those issues. And I think that our willingness to have that dialogue and the community's willingness to have it with us goes a long way. And when you look at situations like what happened in Ferguson, and I can't speak to Ferguson, I don't know what others know about that terrible situation that deconstructed a community and broke down its relationship with its local government and its police. I don't know what led to that, but I can tell you in my 33 years of professional law enforcement experience, that does not happen overnight.
Yes.
Somewhere along the way, trust broke down, communication broke down, all those things that are so critically important in relationships and relationship building began to deteriorate. So the message I wanted to communicate at the forum, which I think I successfully communicated, was one, you know, we as an organization, a law enforcement organization, recommit ourselves to certain values to this community that they can expect from us. And one is to obey the rule of law to provide services that are respectful, professional, and constitutional, to be more transparent in all those areas that are high-risk, critical things that we do every day, to do a better job partnering with the community to increase minority representation in our department, and to be very aggressive about how we go about doing that. And I think that sets the right tone for what people can expect from this organization. And I was very candid, and I'll say it again. If I don't honor these commitments, then you have a right to ask that I be replaced. I'm that serious about the commitment we make to this community. And I think that level of openness and commitment and transparency, although some will be critical of it, will help prevent from the breakdown of trust and communication that would lead to something as tragic as what we saw in Missouri.
Thank you, Chief. That we're going to stop right now and take a break. Stay with us, everyone. We'll be right back in a moment with the Chief of Police of Charlottesville, Virginia, Tim Longo. Stay with us.
And now, another film rental discovery. This is the Indie Film Minute. Here's a real trip for you. It's called The Trip, a hilarious pseudo-documentary foodie road film by Michael Winterbottom. It's about a pair of professional actors commissioned by The Observer to do a fancy restaurant tour through England's Lake District. Friends and rival comedians Steve Coogan and Rob Brydon roughly play themselves. Much of the banter between them is improvised. As they drive through some of England's most magnificent scenery, they struggle to outdo each other with Michael Caine impressions, sharp insults, and politically incorrect talk of friendship, family, sex, and midlife crises. They pause only to bed a waitress or two, sleep, consume fine wines, and oh yes, endure the gourmet meals, including way too many scallops. Despite the bravado in both men, a surprising insecurity and vulnerability is allowed to rise to the surface almost inadvertently to give The Trip a truly appealing humanity. Winterbottom is better known for his more intense and emotional films like Jude the Obscure and Welcome to Sarajevo. But here, he and his cast are clearly having a ball while still touching on many of life's truisms. Thankfully, watching will not add on the same 8 pounds gained by actor Rob Blyden. The Trip is calorie-free. Independent film where the real stories are told.
Welcome back to the Reasonable Voice Blog Talk Radio. My guest today is the Charlottesville Chief of Police, Tim Longo, and we are talking about Charlottesville and all the things that, all the events we've been going through lately. And one of the questions I wanted to ask Chief Longo is, going back a bit, I have had a guest, John Whitehead, who's the founder and president of the Rutherford Institute, a big civil rights attorney. He is the man who wrote the first anti-drone law in America, and Charlottesville, Virginia, is the first city to have adopted an anti-drone law, meaning no drones may fly in our skies to spy on our people or whatever else drones are capable of. Chief, I don't know how involved you were in that, but I certainly would like to hear your thoughts about drones or no drones, specifically in Charlottesville.
Well, let me say first and foremost, just to be completely open and transparent, that John Whitehead and I are dear friends, and we communicate very frequently on issues that affect our city, and I've sought his advice at council many times about various policy decisions and operational decisions that I need to make from time to time as a police chief.
Excellent.
And I respect his not only his personal opinion, but his respect for and passion for the Constitution of the United States.
Yes.
I think that there is tremendous operational value in video surveillance technology such as that which you can have with respect to deployment of drones under circumstances that have a direct public safety need. For example, missing child,
yes.
Missing vulnerable adult. Circumstances like I'm confronted with now, trying to find Hannah Graham, those are circumstances in which that type of technology can be critically important in helping solve a law enforcement objective.
Mm-hmm.
Once again, I relate it back to video surveillance technology. It depends on how you use it. For example, you have a large protest in a public park, and you fly a drone over the park in the midst of this constitutionally protected activity,
mm-hmm.
one could reasonably perceive that as having a chilling effect on the exercise of a constitutional right, and perhaps not the most objective way in which to use that type of technology. Another could say, well, it's also intelligence gathering. You're gathering intelligence on persons engaged in constitutionally protected rights.
Mm.
Now, what are you going to do with that information? What are you doing with those images? Where are you going to store those images, and for how long are you going to keep them? We're right back to the same issue
yes.
we were with cameras on the mall.
Yes.
And so I think, our council, they took a bold step, and it was a step that they chose to take, and that was to resolve and otherwise prohibit the use of that type of technology within the city. If there came a time when, in fact, I felt as though there was a public safety need to use that technology, under the Code of Virginia, I'm the chief law enforcement officer, so I'm going to have to make the assessment as to what tools I think will effectively help me accomplish a very important law enforcement objective, with keeping in mind the constitutional safeguards that need to be fully considered and in making the decision on whether to use technology or not. There may come a time when I come to our city manager and say, we have the need to use this tool in this city for this purpose and for this reason, and would hope that if it were a clear, unequivocal law enforcement objective, carefully balanced against the constitutional rights of our citizens and their civil liberties, that we could utilize whatever resource necessary under the law to help us accomplish the need that we need to meet.
You know, Chief, I think you really have hit the issue. I'm not one of those who is big on surveillance, and until, of course, as just as you hit me right the center of my argument, and that is when a child goes missing, or someone, Hannah Graham is still a child,
somebody's child, absolutely.
Exactly. And when that happens, you have to go, well, wait a minute, am I impeding the best resources, technology to find this person? So it does give you pause, but I think your point is well taken, as long as we could be assured of this by other law officials, and that is that it's not the surveillance so much, it's the NSA accused of saving it, and what you do with it after that is the concern. As John Whitehead and I say, all of America is supposed to be a free speech zone, and I guess it's okay to take video of it, just what you do with it, that video after you get it, I suppose.
Yeah, and there's a we've tried to do a better job. I know I personally have tried to do a better job at improving constitutional literacy in law enforcement, and particularly around First Amendment issues, because historically we've done a fairly good job at teaching police officers, law enforcement officers, sheriff's deputies, federal law enforcement agencies about what I call the constitutional criminal procedural safeguards in our Bill of Rights, the Fourth Amendment, the Fifth Amendment, the Sixth Amendment, to some extent the Eighth Amendment, and of course the 14th Amendment, but
yes.
We've done not a very good job at teaching about what the First Amendment, the four freedoms of the First Amendment
yes.
are, and how they relate to law enforcement, and they have a direct relationship, and we see it in just the enforcement of disorderly conduct and obstruction of justice statutes,
yes.
For example, of which are under tremendous scrutiny because of the way they impact First Amendment rights. And now we see the issue with private citizens that are engaging in filming of law enforcement officers and public officials engaged in public duties. And, you can't help but to go online and Google these terrible situations where people are getting their iPhones taken from them, and they're being arrested
yes.
for various charges, and the contents of their iPhones are being deleted. And just terrible images that, unfortunately, we in law enforcement have to kind of step up to the plate and say, we got to prevent this from happening. And how do you do that? Well, how you do it is you do a better job at training those who have taken an oath to support and defend the Constitution, to make sure that their constitutional literacy is what it should be. Because while they may not be constitutional scholars, as I say very often, they're constitutional practitioners, probably more so than anyone else in the criminal justice system.
I agree with that. And that was excellent, Chief. I'm wondering about one of the things I, again, wanted to originally speak with you about. I reported that the University of Virginia police have 12 12 M16s. And I've used an M16 in the military. I know what it's capable of. And although they are reporting that these particular M16s are not automatic weapons, as I have fired, but they still fire every time someone pulls the triggers. And wherever you're pointing it, something gets hit. An M16 is an impressive held weapon. What I know you don't want to second guess another police unit, but what are your thoughts about a university, any university, needing M16s?
Well, you've already preempted my response. I'm not certainly going to try to think for a university police chief and the evaluation of what tools they think they may need to accomplish their specific mission. I will say to you that this issue of law enforcement agencies, whether they be university, local, sheriff's departments, municipalities, you know, we've been engaged in this program with the federal government for many, many years, where we
yes.
have taken equipment that have been decommissioned, and it's not just weapons. If you can think of it, it's among those list of things that the federal government decommissions and makes readily available to local law enforcement. And, over the years, we've accepted such equipment. Some of the equipment that we've accepted that may have been automatic, as you've indicated, those features have been deactivated. I don't think I need an automatic weapon in the city of Charlottesville. But here's the deal, and I've said this before, and others have probably heard me say it, and perhaps you'll agree, this is an evil world that we live in.
Yes.
There are countless incidents that have occurred throughout our country on college campuses, in elementary schools, in movie theaters, in shopping malls,
yes.
in public places where evil people have done terribly evil things that we need to, as first responders, react to, and react to in a way sometimes that requires overwhelming force in a very decisive way. And so there's to have the ability to access tools that will help us accomplish that is really important, provided that there are very, very specific policies and protocols in place that govern when those tools are utilized, how they're utilized, and who authorizes their use. I'll give you an example of our SWAT team. We have a part-time SWAT team. That means they have other jobs within the department, and they are SWAT operators when they're activated. They train 16 hours plus a month.
Mm.
They're highly equipped, highly skilled at what they do. But today, that SWAT operator might be a school resource officer or a detective or a patrol person or a patrol supervisor. And it's only when we activate the team that they're SWAT operators. Well, the process by which that team gets activated is very detailed. One, we apply the facts related to the incident to a threat matrix. Those facts have to score a certain score before there's even a consideration or a request made whether they'll be activated. And then the ultimate decision to activate them is mine. It's the chief law enforcement officer's decision. And that's done in a very calculated way. And we said to our community, you know, when we activate the team, you got a right to ask why. And I'll tell you why. We applied it to the threat matrix, and this is what it told us. I think if people would feel more comfortable about some of these issues what John would refer to as the militarization of the civilian police departments.
Yes.
I think most people would get that from Columbine forward, and the list goes on and on, that thank God that there were tools in place such as armored vehicles to go into hot zones and extract injured people and deliver human assets to terminate the threat before more people were killed. People can get their head around that making a whole lot of sense. As long as you just don't parade those things around the streets of your city every day.
Exactly.
That they're reserved for situations where they're absolutely necessary for you to carry out the mission, and that there's a process in place to in fact deploy those resources. I think if we did a better job at explaining that, or to the extent others don't have those processes in place, that they put them in place,
exactly,
I think people would feel more comfortable about it.
And I couldn't agree more. I'm certainly I land on the side of not too much surveillance, and certainly not militarizing a police department. But as you say, I am, when I see what the world has become, and when I see young people being being abducted and abused, I say, well, we need to apply certain technology, but it does need to have some kind of legal oversight, as you're saying, Chief, that says, how are we going to use this and when, and not just make it to be the normal response or police response to a situation that doesn't have the severity of, say, a Boston Marathon bombing. Now, there, we need a different response than in other things. But which makes me wonder, I remember the two points I wanted to ask you in what little time we have left. One is about open carry. We, not terribly long ago, we had an incident in a local Kroger here in Charlottesville.
Yes.
And how do you feel about body cameras on police? If you can try and hit those two in the time we have left, I'd appreciate it.
Can I go to body cameras first?
Yes.
I think that's hugely important. Here's what we know about body cameras just in the very short period of time in which they've been deployed nationally. We've seen two things drop. One, use of force incidents against citizens, that's a good thing.
Yes.
Complaints against police officers have reduced, that's a good thing.
Yes.
People behave better when they're on camera. Your background, you know, when that camera's on stage or wherever,
yes.
You know, you're at your best, right?
That's right.
You're at your best. The same thing on the streets. People, when they know that they're being filmed, they're going to behave better.
Yes.
They're going to behave better. Citizens are going to behave better. So there's a huge accountability feature that comes with body cameras. But there's also the evidentiary value that the raw footage. And of course, you know what? Well, how do we know that it hasn't been tampered with? How do we know it was preserved property? How do we know that, you know, it's truly the competent evidence that you're suggesting it is? Well, again, that's where process procedure come into play. But the principle of having that in real time, point of view, perspective on video is, I think, very helpful to law enforcement and certainly to the community.
Yes.
I'm a big advocate of it. We have, we've just gotten RFPs back that we're reviewing to select down the road a vendor to equip our officers with body cameras. We've had in-car cameras for years. They've been very successful. Now, you know, open carry. I come from a state where I spent most of my law enforcement career where concealed weapons permits were issued by the state police. They were issued very cautiously with much reservation. It was highly uncommon for me to walk down the streets of Baltimore City and seeing anyone with a gun on their hip that wasn't a law enforcement officer.
Yes.
Virginia, different, right? People can have, you know, open carry and I support and defend the Constitution, even though it's, you know, the Second Amendment's only been the topic of the Supreme Court some five times in the last 222 years. It's just in the past couple of years we've learned that, well, it applies to everybody, not just the militia. And secondly, it also applies to the state. So there's not a lot of Supreme Court jurisprudence with respect to the Second Amendment, although
yes.
It's such a hugely important aspect of our Bill of Rights, and certainly one that I support. But when you look at an incident like the Kroger incident, where an individual is walking through a crowded grocery store,
yes.
In the aftermath of some events that have occurred nationally, where persons have utilized such weaponry to kill other people, and their purpose, and I'm just, you know, hypothetically, their purpose is to advocate Second Amendment rights. I don't think that that's a smart way to advocate.
No.
I think that frightened people, and it could have resulted in an unfortunate and unnecessary tragedy.
Yes.
In the name of advocacy, and I just don't think it's a smart way to advocate.
Well, I guess if nothing else, and we certainly have covered a great deal of tremendous value in our conversation today, Chief, we have learned the importance of nuance. It's not all black or white, and the importance of certainly if you're going to use technology as a resource for surveillance to help protect society, the real question then is to assure society that technology will not take advantage of their privacy after the fact. You have made all those points as usual brilliantly, Chief Longo. I know you are passionate about your job, and that job obviously is sometimes a lot more demanding than most of us can even begin to imagine. I want to thank you so much for being on the show today and all that you're doing. And I wish you all the best, you know, with your investigation and with your finding Hannah Graham.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you. Bye now.
Stay with us as we'll be right back with a final comment from The Reasonable Voice.
And now, another film rental discovery.
This is the Indie Film Minute. Here's a real trip for you. It's called The Trip, a hilarious pseudo-documentary foodie road film by Michael Winterbottom. It's about a pair of professional actors commissioned by The Observer to do a fancy restaurant tour through England's Lake District. Friends and rival comedians Steve Coogan and Rob Brydon roughly play themselves. Much of the banter between them is improvised. As they drive through some of England's most magnificent scenery, they struggle to outdo each other with Michael Caine impressions, sharp insults, and politically incorrect talk of friendship, family, sex, and midlife crises. They pause only to bed a waitress or two, sleep, consume fine wines, and oh yes, endure the gourmet meals, including way too many scallops. Despite the bravado in both men, a surprising insecurity and vulnerability is allowed to rise to the surface almost inadvertently to give The Trip a truly appealing humanity. Winterbottom is better known for his more intense and emotional films like Jude the Obscure and Welcome to Sarajevo. But here, he and his cast are clearly having a ball while still touching on many of life's truisms. Thankfully, watching will not add on the same 8 pounds gained by actor Rob Blyden. The Trip is calorie-free. Independent film where the real stories are told.
Hello, I'm Marcello Rolando, The Reasonable Voice, thanking you for joining us in becoming one of the reasonable voices heard around the world. Ferguson, mental health, life and death. Ferguson, Missouri, in all its anger, violence, militarized police brutality, government racial imbalance, and street arms raised unity, is America in miniature. Discriminating political redistricting and prioritizing profit power over people power are co-creators of Divided We Fall. However, the diminishing of our First Amendment rights to peacefully assemble and protest didn't begin with police. Policeman Darren Wilson shooting an unarmed Michael Brown, robbery suspect or not, multiple times. It began with Attorney General John Ashcroft's administrative decree to quarantine dissent, which then standardized designated protest areas as our new First Amendment MO. It began with President George W. Bush's political events banning and arresting those peacefully wearing anti-Bush t-shirts. It began with our Pentagon buying surplus war weaponry from those who profit from our being at war, and then giving the surplus munitions to police departments all over America. It began with DWB, FWA, SWB, and Trayvon Martin's crime, WWB. It began with Andrew Jackson slaughtering Native Americans, our Civil War never ending, 60s assassinations, a uniformed Oakland, California thug pepper spraying sitting peaceful demonstrators. It began with people being left to die in New Orleans after Katrina and Michael Brown's body left in the street for hours. The systemic stigmatizing of those deemed different is as old as the Salem and McCarthy witch hunts, as prescient as the ongoing war on women from no voting rights to institutionalizing women for sexual orgasmic enjoyment with their husbands, to states blocking the ratification of the Equal Rights Amendment. It's as new as veterans dying waiting for health care, and as old as the cataclysmic void in our treatment and understanding of Americans with mental health issues, allowing them still in the 21st century to live without help for depression like 19th century outcasts. We are not what we see on television, whether scripted sitcoms or news media. We are who we love and emulate, what we vote for and fight against, and how we treat one another. Death in all of its forms, whether Lauren Bacall and Charles Keating, or New York chokehold and Ohio Walmart shot for being black, or Anne Sexton, Seymour Hoffman, and Robin Williams, death in all its forms cuts painfully into our 6 degrees of separation. I didn't know Robin Williams. Indeed, the closest I came to it was his co-stars, literally bumping into Nathan Lane one night after his brilliant performance in The Producers, officers and chanting on the set of Lincoln with Sally Field. But on so many levels, the death of Robin Williams hurts, just like losing my close friends and colleagues, J.D. Waring, Father Gilbert Harkey, and the iconic actress Mercedes McCambridge. I knew the addiction Mercedes was successfully resisting before her son, John Lawrence Fitzfield, killed himself after murdering his wife and two daughters. I know our stigmatizing mental illness and our ignorance of depression, schizophrenia, and Alzheimer's is as deadly as a militarized police state. I know Ferguson is an America from which we can learn life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, or continued supreme distrust of our legal system. Not all battles are civil wars between Christians and non, rich and poor, or even black and white, but increasingly, too many are. Perhaps in an election year, we and our governments and law enforcement at all levels have received a revelation. Ferguson, mental health, and life and death in America. Join us. Become one of the reasonable voices heard round the world. Thank you.
Thank you for continuing to listen to, support, and share the Reasonable Voice Blog Talk Radio with family and friends, especially online. We enjoy hearing from you, and in response, yes, we are now accepting new company and business advertisers and welcoming organizations seeking to be one of our sponsors. So please do continue to email us at thereasonablevoice@gmail.com. However, if you prefer to simply make a donation, your donations are greatly appreciated and can be made through PayPal by clicking on the donate button found at the top of the homepage of the Reasonable Voice. Voice.com website.
Thank you for joining us today to make every day as reasonable as possible. We hope you will download and share our downloadable podcasts. I am Marcello Rolando, the Reasonable Voice, hoping you will become one of the reasonable voices heard round the world.